Today, the world is demanding more of products and packaging. They need to meet consumer demands, be sustainable, and travel through different channels. Simply put, companies that make things need to respond faster than ever to change. So let's go beyond the shelf to understand how industry leaders in food and beverage, beauty, CPG, industrials, and more are driving innovation in their products and packaging. Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Shelf, the product and packaging podcast, where we interview the people behind the amazing products we use every day. I'm Laura Foti, and today I'm thrilled to be speaking with longtime retail executive turned CPG investor, Carl Bracken. Carl is the founder and CEO of Ocampo Capital, an early stage consumer venture capital firm. Ocampo Capital is a trajectory amplifier for young consumer businesses. It provides investment, hands-on operational support, and consulting services to help accelerate growth and achieve their aspirations. Prior to launching Ocampo Capital, Carl spent 20 years as an executive at consumer companies, including 15 years at Target Corporation, where amongst other roles, he was the architect and leader of their supply chain transformation, and previously led the rollout of perishable food to all stores. Most recently, Carl was the chief merchant and head of global supply chain at Guitar Center. Carl sits on the board of directors of Shameless Pets and is an advisory board member of TH Lee Partners Automation Fund, Claremont McKenna College's Randall Lewis Center of Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and Santa Clara University's Retail Management Institute. He is also an advisor to several companies, including Conlego, Future Fan, Small Wonder, and Miles. He is a BA from Claremont McKenna College, where he captained the NCAA baseball team, and an MBA from the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where, fun fact, we shared an accounting professor. Carl, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you, Laura.
Yeah. Amazing resume, first of all. You've been around retail for almost 20 years. Looking back, you know, what were some of the inflection points you witnessed in that industry?
Yeah, I've seen a lot. And so, you know, I guess this says a little bit about how long I've been in the industry. But, you know, a couple of things I would say. One is, just to step back, retail is always evolving and it's always changing. That's what one of the things that makes it really interesting. But it's also, you know, a challenge. It's one of the least stable industries I think there is out there, and is prone to disruption because customers are fickle and they're generally not loyal. And so because of that, you know, you can have all sorts of disruption and all sorts of kind of inflection points. You know, in my career, a few of the ones that really jump out at me, the first one is the obvious emergence and rise of Amazon. You know, one thing that people don't know, which I think is kind of telling, is on September 11th, 2001, Jeff Bezos was actually in Target's headquarters because they were going to announce that morning that Target's website was going to be hosted by Amazon. And they had to delay the announcement, obviously, but it gives you a little bit of a sense of kind of where the balance of power was then and how much that ended up changing, you know, in the subsequent years. So obviously that was a big deal. Another big sort of, I would say, inflection point is retailers kind of later learning how to effectively compete with Amazon. And a lot of it was, you know, the emergence of omnichannel, kind of trying to use your stores as fulfillment nodes, things like that, which ties in kind of a lot to the work I did in the supply chain transformation at Target, but a lot of retailers have kind of figured that out or are in the process of figuring that one out. The third one that I would say has been kind of a long kind of changing trajectory, but that it did reach kind of an inflection point in the past, I would say 10 or 15 years, is private brands becoming not such a differentiator, but now like a competitive threat to major manufacturers. And so, you know, you think back on it, private brands are not a new thing. You know, think about Sears with all the private brands that they kind of created, you know, Kenmore Appliances and, you know, Craftsman Tools, Die Hard Batteries. You know, even like Allstate Insurance was a private brand launched by Sears, which is pretty incredible in the early 1930s. So, you know, they've been around a long time, but, you know, the push of private brands now to be such a kind of a threat to national brands has accelerated a lot in the past few years. Another one I would definitely call out is the rise of mobile commerce. Mobile commerce changed everything. You think about, you know, price transparency. You know, you think about researching at shelf. And, you know, I can guarantee you that mobile commerce has probably put a lid on inflation, particularly in kind of considered purchase good items, because of the ability to transparently see the price. It's just really, really a huge, huge kind of innovation. And on that one in particular, this hits close to home for me because this is kind of a fun fact. I actually, the night that the iPhone was first announced, the first iPhone, I had dinner with Tim Cook that night. And it's a crazy story, but I was actually the merchant for Audio Electronics at the time. And we had picked up market share. So he had scheduled this dinner to congratulate us on our market share gains. And lo and behold, you know, I'm sitting at the table with Tim Cook the night the iPhone was announced. And he's talking about how you can use your fingers to zoom in on the New York Times and be able to read the article on your phone. And it seemed like totally revolutionary to me at the time. I had no clue what it would do to upend retail as an industry and you know, create a huge inflection point. But, you know, that obviously was to come in a few years after that. But, you know, those are some of the big ones. I would say the last sort of big inflection point that I've seen in my career is how products get to store shelves and how distribution centers have changed. I mean, it's completely different. You know, you think about automation, robotics, you think about, you know, flexible warehouse management systems. Like those are all reasonably new. You know, I think there's been more changes in the past 15 years in distribution centers than there probably were in the 75 years before that. It's just incredible, you know, like how fast the rate of change has happened there. So lots of change.
There's so much we can unpack here and probably spend entire episodes on some of these. The Tim Cook story is awesome. What was it like to, I mean, he's now one of the most successful CEOs of all time. He's helped Apple gain more, you know, larger cap, market cap than even Steve Jobs did. What was it like to have dinner with him?
Well, I met with him probably five times when I was in that role. So I had met him before then. So it wasn't like the first time meeting him. But, you know, I will tell you, he is, his brain is like a computer. I mean, the guy is so smart. And, you know, anytime I would come up with a point, you could tell that his brain, the cogs were turning. And if I said anything that wasn't factually perfectly accurate, he would find it in about 2 seconds. But he was like a really nice guy, you know, very driven, but, you know, humble and, you know, very much like, you know, had the Apple brand first and foremost in his mind at all times. He's a very impressive person.
One of the things I find interesting about Target is when I'm in the store and I have trouble finding things, I'll pull up the app and actually look at where I'm located in the store and what aisle I need to go to. And I've noticed personally, I've cut down on the times I'm bothering store associates, asking them where something is because I can find it myself. Like that is amazing as a consumer. Like I don't want to bother someone. Yeah. And so like, that's one area where mobile, I definitely see mobile in there. Another one is with private label. Target's done an amazing job with their private label brands to the point where I don't even realize it's not a national brand because they have certain different names for them. My personal favorite right now is the cauliflower pizza. Highly recommend those out there. Really great price point, really great quality, great nutritional. And so if you're, you know, a lot of our listeners are on the product development and packaging side of the business. And so so much of what you said around number one, Target offering their own private brands. And so if you're a company, this might be an opportunity for you to gain market share through kind of a by being the brand for Target, right? So there's one aspect. Absolutely. And then the second aspect around automation and thinking of the store as a distribution center, really, there's a huge impact on packaging there. So if you had advice for people listening on those two topics, like what do you wish they knew when you were in your role?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, understanding the consumer and understanding what the consumer demands, obviously very, very important. You know, I think while Target does have a lot of private label brands, particularly in the consumable spaces, they use third parties to manufacture the product for them. So, you know, so you can definitely, as a manufacturer, kind of align yourself with that and pick up that kind of piece of the business. But also to your point, like, yeah, private brand doesn't mean it needs to be white label. I mean, it can be definitely be differentiated. It can be a way to add, you know, additional consumer value add. It can mean lots of different things, you know, hitting on white space potentially that's not being addressed by other brands. I mean, there's a lot of ways to compete there that I think can be creative and you know, really important.
Yeah. You've held a variety of different supply chain roles. How has that shaped your approach as a leader? And what advice would you have to people who have maybe stayed in one area of supply chain who want to grow into more of that broader executive?
We'll be right back. Speaking of innovation, is your team spending more time chasing data than on new product and packaging development? SpecRite can help. With our specification data management platform, you can streamline project management, quickly build out BOMs, and forecast both the profitability and sustainability of your products. Go to specart.com to learn more. Now back to the show.
Yeah, you know, several things here. I would say probably the most important thing is, you know, being intellectually curious. I think intellectual curiosity in my career has really seems like that is the indicator of who's going to end up kind of being most successful and rise to leadership positions. You have to be intellectually curious. I think the other piece is, you know, having the ability to see, kind of have a different point of view and different angles on a supply chain business by seeing, you know, other parts of the retail kind of career path is helpful. For me, you know, I originally started my career in finance before I even got into retail. And so I think I understood financials a bit, you know, when I got into becoming a merchant. And then as a merchant, I think I learned a lot in kind of that career path on what does the consumer want? You know, what are they demanding? You know, how do I negotiate effectively? And, you know, and those pieces I think were helpful then as I got into the supply chain, you know, from the standpoint of like understanding from a consumer's point of view and understanding sort of puts and takes, you know, in the metrics in order to drive kind of the best outcome for the company. And so, you know, having a bit of a 360 view on the business, regardless of what, you know, career path you're going down, but to be able to see things from multiple different angles, I think is just really, really valuable.
Absolutely. And it just that cross-functional supply chain is so cross-functional. So being able to experience those functions and have empathy for them, I think definitely leads to more effectiveness. You know, you've held some really interesting roles, you know, at Target specifically in the supply chain transformation and then with food perishables. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced? Those are really big projects. And how did you navigate them?
Yeah. So within the supply chain specifically, I would say, you know, there's a lot of things that were challenges. You know, things like the West Coast port slowdown was a huge challenge to manage through. You know, there's tough business environments you have to manage through, things like that. But for me, I would say the biggest challenge, particularly in the supply chain transformation work, was kind of rallying the team and the culture changes associated with it. You know, basically we were breaking the status quo and, you know, there was that old saying, like pioneers are the ones with arrows in their backs. And I think there's truth to that. Like you're going out on a limb and you're saying that the current state is not working and we have to do it differently. That is threatening to a lot of people, you know? And so how do you effectively bring them along and help them to understand why it's a better path forward than the path that you're currently on? That was probably the most difficult part. I would say, you know, the politics and the cultural sort of changes required were hard to navigate. And
how did you do it? I mean, obviously Target's very successful today, arguably one of the most successful retailers at competing with Amazon. So what were some of the things that allowed you to break through? And I think a lot of our listeners can empathize with that. A lot of them want to change, want to digitize, but are up against that same feeling. So how did you successfully navigate that?
A lot of it was storytelling, kind of setting the vision and explaining the vision. I think a big part of it also was having very clear proof points that you could call out on a regular basis as to progress. You know, it looks like an avalanche coming at you, but if you can break it down into snowflakes, like it's a lot more manageable. That is really, really crucial. It definitely tasked my public speaking ability, I'll be honest, you know, and so, you know, being able to consistently tell the story and explain why it mattered was really, really sort of important. And then, you know, we eventually had to get our vendors on board with it too. And I would say that was in some ways harder than getting our own team on board because there was a lot of change management for our vendors. And, you know, they didn't necessarily see the benefit in the change, you know, at the point that Target itself did. So it was a lot of that. It was really breaking it down into bite-sized pieces, telling the story, repeating the vision, explaining it, and then giving proof points on the sort of path towards success was really, really crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what piece of the business were you trying to transform, and what was the ultimate transformation that took place?
So the main sort of the initial concept, as I put it forward to our CFO at the time, was, you know, Target has 1,800 stores. What if we had 1,800 distribution points and allowed us to leapfrog Amazon by being able to deliver product to the end consumer faster than they can? What would Amazon give to have 1,800 distribution centers? And that was the sort of rallying cry in the vision. Now, how do you achieve that? Well, you know, we had to combine our stores and .com inventory management systems. Those were two totally different inventory management systems. we had to combine the teams so that it was one team, multi-channel. We had to launch pick up in store and ship from store first, because those are the end consumer facing products that would unlock then all the things that had to happen behind it, which included, you know, making our back rooms into mini fulfillment centers. How do you pick and pack product from a sales floor using sort of a warehouse management system type thing to walk the sales floor of the store in order to be able to pick and pack and ship the product? And then it was, what do you do upstream in the distribution centers so that they can be efficient and effective at nimbly kind of being broken down and shipped faster and more accurately so that you could achieve that? So that was a big part of it. There was also systematic issues with, you know, if you have misallocated inventory, how do you reallocate it virtually so that you can ship it? There was a lot behind it, you know, and it did mean looking at the trade-offs between different, you know, line items on the P&L. Sometimes you want to take more ship expense so you can save on some other line item, or you have greater in-stocks, those kinds of things. And aligning those incentives across different line items in the P&L were part of what was so hard about it. Because, you know, there are people there in transportation that wanted to save, you know, truck shipments or wanted to keep out trailers to the biggest degree. And then there's other people that wanted, like merchants that wanted in-stocks to be 100%. You know, it's all trade-offs. So that was a big part of it, was understanding the trade-offs.
What an amazing story. I mean, you literally rebuilt how the business operated. And that resonates so much with what we talk to people about at SpecRite. As I always say, like, you have to reimagine how you're managing supply chain data. Like, it's not an incremental thing. And what I love about retailers is, like you said, retailers are forced to change so much because the competitive environment is so intense that you guys really didn't have a choice, right? There wasn't a just like, we could stick it out. I mean, Amazon had so shifted consumers and reoriented people around a different type of purchasing that everyone kind of had to follow suit. It's interesting because I actually don't have an Amazon Prime account. I leverage Target's buy online, pick up in store. I actually love the, like, where they bring it to your car. I never want to go to curbside. I'm that person. I'm like, boom, I'm there multiple times a week. If I could, I would pay to have it ready for me in 20 minutes versus 2 hours. I'm like, I don't know why that isn't a feature yet. Because I like the Target products. So that's why I'm buying it there. And like, to me, there's still an opportunity for a little bit more speed. And I think there's some consumers who would pay for it, but I continue to be excited about what they're rolling out. Like I said, even the in-store experience is great. The product assortment's great. So I'm super excited. I love following along there. You know, the importance of packaging to retailers has grown tremendously over the years. You're advising a lot of consumer companies now. What's your perspective on this?
You know, I think the importance of packaging, totally agree with you that it's becoming more important. And I would say it's becoming more important in kind of two major ways. One is functionally, it's becoming more important. And then I think the other piece is sort of aesthetically, it's becoming more important. So when I think about kind of on the functional side, you know, packaging does a few things that can be really beneficial. One is it can unlock kind of a reduction in waste. And that's huge. That improves margins. It's good for the environment. There's a lot of reasons why that's good. And so under that, you have things like the strength of packaging. I personally have seen instances where, you know, people have tried to cut corners by making the packaging a little bit, you know, less strong, save a cent or two here, but then you have massive, you know, shrink issues on the back end. You know, that's, you know, something that I think is really crucial. Secondly, case pack optimization, particularly in an environment now where some retailers are doing dynamic case packs. That is, you know, a huge change and very important from the standpoint of allocation accuracy of product and, you know, having supply meet demand. Like that's really crucial, and that's becoming more and more important. I would say the third piece, and this is totally, I think, core to what you guys do, is, you know, accurate weights and dimensions. They're more and more important now than they've ever been. And the reason being is because, you know, you're trying to intelligently pack out trailers, you're trying to reduce rework, you're trying to, you know, kind of allow your network to move more smoothly, particularly in a modern network. You got to have accurate data. And that's just really, really crucial. And then I would say, lastly, from a functional standpoint, kind of last mile delivery to home, like that, it's really crucial. You know, if you can have a package that can withstand that last mile shipment and doesn't require additional overpacking and things like that, really big. So all those things functionally are becoming more and more important. On the aesthetic side, I think there's a lot there. Like, and that's also becoming more important. So first of all, you know, packaging is kind of the product's billboard at shelf. And consumers don't really want someone coming in and helping them figuring out what to buy. They need to kind of figure it out on their own and want to figure it out on their own. So the packaging has to tell the story. It's marketing. It can also be a huge innovator. So like I'll give you two sort of quick examples on that. One is my first full-time job at Target, I was the merchant for a prescription pharmacy. And prescription pharmacy by law is not allowed to be differentiated. It has to be what it is. But packaging could be a differentiator. And so we actually launched something called ClearRx, which was the upside down pill bottle with like a flat facing on it and different colored rings. And so why did we do that? And so you could have a bigger typeface on the label, but also you could have different color rings. So each family member has a different color, and that would reduce the likelihood that people would take each other's medication on accident. And so there was an actual consumer benefit from that. So that's one example. Another one is a company that I've invested in. It's called Small Wonder. Small Wonder makes water-free salon-grade shampoo and conditioner. So it's powder, and you put it under the shower head and rub your hands together, and it reconstitutes into shampoo and conditioner. And it's a really awesome product. But part of what makes the product awesome is the packaging keeps it from getting wet until you want it to get wet. And so that's a huge innovator and a huge unlock for what makes that product cool. So anyway, there's so many reasons why packaging is more important, but you know, functional and aesthetic.
I love stories like that. I mean, it's funny. I'll post this on LinkedIn, but I was in a retailer last night, walking by, and I saw these mugs, and they were like big mugs, espresso like cups, and they were brown, and it said little brown mug, little brown cup.
Oh,
can you guess what retailer I was in? It was a playoff of Little Brown. It's a playoff of Little Brown Bag, which is Bloomingdale's.
Bloomingdale's, that's smart.
Their packaging is so iconic. They're now making products about the packaging. And I'm like, this is my whole thesis, right? Like, you can't separate these two anymore. Packaging is the product in so many cases now.
Yeah.
Like, it is the differentiator. It is part of the thing we think we're buying, that it's, and to me, that's like the ultimate manifestation of it. And I love hearing stories about Small Wonder where like the packaging is a key part of what brings the value proposition to life. Right. And if that packaging fails, like everything else does too. And exactly. You mentioned shrinkage. Shrinkage is this damaged goods, right? Which yep. The retailer's like, we can't put these on the shelf. We're throwing them away or charging them back. And for every company exactly. That talks about sustainability, I don't hear them talking about eliminating shrinkage and there's so much work we can do by improving packaging on it, but it's all about trade-offs, right? And so a lot of companies are especially now facing cost pressures.
Yep.
Looking for those optimizations when, you know, shout out to our friends at ISTA, you need to be running those through your ISTA testing and saying, is it still going to make it, right? Because you have to have that like 360 degree analysis of how packaging impacts your supply chain now. Like, you can no longer make packaging decisions in a silo. It has to be, you have to evaluate it by so many different angles, which makes it challenging. So I love those stories. You were, you know, at Guitar Center, you were EVP of private brands, which surprised me. I didn't know Guitar Center made guitars. I see you have one behind you. What did that entail? Like, what was Guitar Center making?
Yeah. So it's, most people know this, but 20% of what Guitar Center sells is private brands. They have over 20 private brand brands. And yeah, they have guitars that are private brand. They have keyboards, drum sets. You know, they make private brand product across pretty much most of the categories of musical instruments they sell. So, and it's like a private brand, you know, manufacturing arm for a Target or for other companies. They, you know, design the product, they source it through factories in Asia and bring it over in containers and sell them in the stores. So yeah, it's a core competency for them and a differentiator.
That's awesome. You know, what advice would you give someone looking to eventually move into a leadership role? I know we touched on it briefly about getting different cross-functional experiences, but you know, you've also moved companies. You know, what are your thoughts for folks that are thinking about the future of their careers?
I love that question. You know, I would say, like I mentioned before, being broadly intellectually curious is really, really important. You know, the second thing that I think is really important is being empathetic. You know, people that can empathize with others tend to be better at getting them to follow their lead. And so as a leader, you know, if you can empathize with the people on your team and, you know, kind of understand where they're coming from and meet them where they are to be able to get them to, you know, to rally around a cause is, you know, really, really important. And then the third piece I would say is, and this is advice I actually got from one of my mentors at Target, which was really, really good, was, you know, think of your career as like a T. So the horizontal bar of the T is sort of the breadth of all the skills you have and you have to be good at in order to be considered functionally capable. And so you don't want to have any Achilles heels. You want to be at least adequate at every single one of those skills along that horizontal T. And then the vertical line is, what do you do better than anybody else in the company? What is your sort of calling card? What are you known for as this is sort of your area of expertise? What's your superpower? And if you know what that is and you have something that you do better than everyone else, but then you also have a wide set of skills and don't have any Achilles heels, you're going to be relevant your entire career and you're going to keep moving up into leadership positions. And I think that's just a really great way to think about, you know, career development and the fact that we're all kind of always in the nature of becoming better and better. You never really get there, but, you know, that's a good way to think about it.
I love that advice. And it's so actionable for especially our packaging listeners because packaging touches everything.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're interested in moving up in supply chain and you're a packaging professional, work on projects with the new product development people and focus on new product development, you know, packaging for NPD. If you yep. want to get into quality, you know, find a packaging issue and work with your quality team to fix it, right? And for procurement, right? Figure out a way to source something differently or report on sustainability. There's so many ways that packaging and product teams can get that cross-functional experience. You know, one of the other things that I've personally witnessed, Carl, is that there's a lot of friction sometimes between supply chain or, you know, teams and organizations. How do you think teams can better work together? Because they're always aligned on accomplishing the same mission, but oftentimes there's friction. And so, you know, how do you think people can move past that?
I think a big part of it is having everyone have aligned incentives and focused on sort of the biggest goal. Like at the end of the day, within a company, every member of the supply chain wants to see the company be successful. You know, and if you want to see the company be successful, then instead of being focused on your KPI that is for your specific job function and optimizing for that may suboptimize the whole, getting everyone kind of rallied around what matters most for the company as a whole and understanding there's going to be times you're going to win and sometimes you're going to lose in your specific KPI. But if it's pushing the company forward, you know, that really is what matters most. And so, you know, I think of like, you know, I mentioned a little bit earlier, but things like, you know, sometimes it's not right to cube out a trailer if you're not in stock in a store. You know, sometimes it's better to have a case pack of one and sending it more frequently through your supply chain than a case pack of 144 that you send very infrequently. You know, and so it's within a supply chain, I think it really boils down to, I think people's hearts are in the right place and they want to do the right thing. It's just oftentimes that the incentives aren't aligned and the KPIs that they're focused on may not be totally aligned every single day with what's best for the company. And so yeah. being able to see holistically and being able to make trade-offs in order to drive the ship to a greater extent, I think is really, really crucial.
Yeah, absolutely. You're now an investor. What do you look for in emerging consumer brands? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I have a few things that I look for thematically. So the first thing is I look for great leadership teams. And by that, I mean, they need to be smart and flexible. No company, you know, sets out to do something and it always works out exactly the way they wanted to. So you have to be able to pivot. And that requires, you know, some smarts and some kind of ability to be nimble. So great leadership teams is the first piece. The second piece I look for is they need to have differentiated product and preferably differentiated product with kind of unique intellectual property attached to it. You know, otherwise you're just kind of chasing a trend and you're just kind of gambling, thinking you're going to end up with the best sort of product within that trend. And that can be pretty tenuous. I think the third thing I look for is I look for brands and categories where I personally have expertise based on my career. So, you know, generally speaking, that's repeat purchase consumable categories and places where you can kind of create loyal customers through repeat purchase. It would be pretty bad if I was investing in a lot of like high fashion apparel. I mean, that's just not where I'm good, you know? So, you know, kind of sticking to my knitting and to the categories I know is really important. And then ideally, this is hard to do, but if you can do it, find brands that compete against non-consumption. And so by that, you know, brands that are, if you didn't buy this product, you wouldn't be buying anything because there's nothing else to trade off against it. Mm. And so, you know, one example of that is a company I've invested in. They're called Future Fans. And what they've created is it's a family experience in a box. So it's like a game. The family members can kind of play together and children bond with their parents over learning the kind of rules of professional sports. And so for parents that are, you know, big sports fans and they want their kids, the young kids, to understand the rules of sports and watch sports with them, they love it. And so it's a cool product. Parents and kids love playing together. You know, with this, they have a football product on the market already, and they're launching a soccer product this coming spring. So anyway, it's innovative. There's nothing like it in the market. And so it is, you know, a cool kind of differentiated way for parents and kids to interact.
Oh, I love that. I'm thinking of all my friends that still make fun of me for not knowing what offsides in soccer is. And I have season tickets to Angel City. And I'm like, I still couldn't tell you some of the rules in soccer. So I might need that. I also imagine this company is poised to take off with all the new viewers from Taylor Swift on the NFL. Wow, that's like fortuitous timing.
The founders actually were at the Super Bowl. And I think there's absolutely, there's opportunity there for sure.
Oh, that's great. Fortune favors the prepared. That's what one of my strategy professors said. Like, you couldn't have planned that if you wanted to.
Well, exactly.
Where are you seeing white space right now in CPG?
Yeah, where I'm seeing it largely is kind of in categories where kind of better, cleaner, safer ingredients or formulations are emerging. And there's a lot of themes that are kind of out there that you can capitalize on. So, you know, I mentioned small wonder. So like, what is that capitalizing on? It's capitalizing on not shipping water. You know, you have a highly concentrated product that doesn't cost as much to ship. It's eco-friendly. The packaging's eco-friendly. Like that is, you know, that's one example. Another one is another company I've invested in called Shameless Pets. That company makes pet treats that are made with upcycled ingredients. So basically what would have been food waste gets reconstituted into ingredients that they make into these pet treats. Pets love it. It's really good for the environment and is another way to kind of capitalize on kind of an emerging trend. So, you know, I think that's pretty cool. And then a third one is, this is a company I'm advising, is a company called Miles. And they have a personal care brand for teens and tweens. So think like deodorant, antiperspirant, things like that. And it's made with clean ingredients. They won numerous packaging design awards. They stand for kind of inclusivity for Gen Z and Gen A, you know, things like that, where there's a differentiation in the product attributes and the product ingredients. And they do something that is, you know, inherently better for the environment or better for the world. So that's where I think there's white space.
Ah, I love that. What you said resonates with me. Every time I use dry shampoo, I feel bad about myself because I'm like, is this going to give me cancer someday? Like, it's a terrible feeling. And I'm like, you know what? The women out here will understand the struggle. So I'm just like, I just keep using it. And I'm like, I hope this formulation doesn't have a PFAS chemical in it.
Exactly.
It's like, well, so I do think there's a huge market for, I'm like, but there's no brands shouting it out at me that there's a clean, safe alternative. So I kind of don't know. Right. Yeah. Anyway, it's a huge opportunity. If you make dry shampoo, think about maybe some better packaging messaging so I can make a good choice there. All right. Carl, I could talk to you all day, but we're going to close out with my favorite segment, which is rapid fire.
Yep. Okay.
What is your favorite product right now?
Okay. So I think I'm going to cheat my answer on this, but I really love is products that I'm loyal to over time because it just stands the test of time for me. So one example is like my New Balance 860 running shoes. Like I love those things. And the reason I love them is because I have plantar fasciitis. I have been like a lifelong runner and I thought that I would never be able to run again when I got plantar fasciitis. But these shoes, I love them. Like they don't make my plantar fasciitis worse. I buy them in bulk. Like I'll literally buy like 5 pairs at a time. And my biggest concern is that someday New Balance is going to come out and say that they're, you know, changing the shoe dimensions or whatever, and it's not going to work for me. So that's why I buy so many at any given time. But yeah, for me, like I am totally loyal to the shoes. Don't change them, New Balance.
That's awesome. If you're listening, packaging trend are you most excited about right now?
You know, we've talked about it a little bit already, but I would say like aesthetically pleasing packaging that actually improves the product experience. You know, I mentioned ClearX at Target or Small Wonder, you know, things where there's innovation that allows not only the product to shine, but the product to actually be accentuated. Packaging, and if you're a packaging engineer, I think this is such an awesome time to be alive, because there's so much, you know, coolness is coming out of packaging and, you know, innovation, and will continue to.
I agree. I think it's an exciting space. Shout out to all. I know so many students getting into the, I get to meet a lot of students, and
oh, that's cool.
They're all like really excited and have so many ideas. And I think the next 20 years in packaging is going to be a really fun time. Okay. Last segment, kill, keep, change. I'm going to give you a list of three random products. You have to pick what you would kill, AKA discontinue, what you would keep, or what you would change. These are not written by me. I just want to say that I have a team of folks who contribute to this, and we have some very random ones today. So Carl, your first one is a thermostat, which we don't really need a lot in Southern California, but you got a thermostat, refried beans, and then a toothpick. So what would you keep? What would you kill? What would you change? You got a thermostat, refried beans, and toothpick.
Oh man. Okay. Let's see here. I would say I would kill refried beans. I just do not like that product. So I don't know if there's anything they could do to change them to make me like them more. So I will say kill. As far as keep, you know, I think thermostat I would keep. There's enough like new innovation happening with thermostats, like with Internet of Things and things like that. I think thermostats are smart now. They don't need to get any smarter. Like, they're good. So I would say keep. And then change, I think the toothpick is classic, but there's got to be more hygienic ways to you know, innovate on the toothpick that actually could help, like hygienically, as well as maybe, you know, better for, I don't know, tooth like hygiene or something like that. So that's what I would say.
We're killing the toothpick. We're just flossing. You heard it here first, folks.
All right.
Awesome. Well, Carl, thank you so much for joining us. How can people follow you and get in touch?
Yeah, they can follow me and my company at ocampocapital.com. So OCAMPOcapital.com. Sign up for my newsletter. I have a newsletter on there. I send it out every other week. And so I would love to have any of you guys follow that. On LinkedIn, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. And then lastly, carl@ocampocapital.com. You can reach me there. So would love to Carl, interact with anybody.
Thanks for sharing all your wisdom and retail and other things. And we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Beyond the Shelf is presented by SpecRite, the first cloud-based platform for specification management. Say goodbye to spreadsheets, share drives, and legacy systems, and digitize your specs in a secure single source of truth. With SpecRite, you can easily share and collaborate on specs with other departments and across your entire supply chain network. Taking a spec-first approach enables you to accelerate product and packaging development, go to bid faster, report on sustainability, and ultimately spend less time chasing data and more time making amazing things. To learn more, visit specrite.com. That's SPECRIGHT.com.